Welcome to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Jane Caro, sitting in for Richard Aidey all this week while he takes a well-earned break. As usual, today we're ranging far and wide, from the renewal of the dying heart of a post-industrial town to students teaching their teachers about learning. Veteran broadcaster Caroline Jones also joins us to talk about her very personal new book, Through the Glass Darkly, so make sure you stick around for that. But to begin, it's not hard to imagine how you might feel if details of your personal counselling sessions were made public, or how much worse you would feel if you were a victim of sexual assault and they were handed to the legal team of your alleged attacker. But that's just what some victims of sexual assault have discovered, that their counselling and medical records can be subpoenaed for use in court. In New South Wales, a new pilot project will offer people who find themselves in this situation free legal representation in an effort to ensure their personal records remain confidential. And the woman who's behind the pilot project joins me in the studio this morning. Alicia Gillard is a solicitor with the Women's Legal Services in New South Wales. Hello and welcome to Life Matters, Alicia.
Hello, thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. To me, and probably to a lot of people, it sounds slightly incredible that a victim of sexual assault could have counselling or medical records later revealed in a courtroom. How does this actually happen?
Well, it was incredible, and laws have actually been in place to protect these counselling notes since 1997. However, these laws, what we've found is that not in effect working. So a counselling note is maintained as confidential, but that doesn't stop the prosecution or the defence requiring those kind of notes to be brought to the court. When it's taken to the court, they first of all need to gain access to it, and there is a defence that can be raised to prevent that, and that's where we come in with a pilot project.
Okay, so there are some protections already, and you're saying the sexual assault communication privilege is one of them, and that's, but you're saying that's not adequate at the moment. So what are the ways that people can get around it?
Well, first of all, victims require free legal representation, and that's not available at the moment in New South Wales. They need someone to go into court for them to say, no, you can't have access to these documents, and to raise the devastating impacts that the revealing of sexual assault counselling notes can have on victims. We also need to amend the laws so that adequate notice is given. These kind of subpoenas are being issued and surprising victims, often just before they're about to head into the courtroom, and you can imagine the destabilising effect that has on people. And for victims who may already be feeling a sense of powerlessness, it can sometimes feel that the accused has all the rights and can do what they like. It can also re-traumatise them and can raise even unassociated fears such as, well, what if my friends and family find out what I've been saying in counselling sessions? Or I had one client who had rather unrelated fears. She thought docs might take her children because of what she said about drug abuse 15 years ago. And this is a woman who'd overcome childhood sexual abuse, a history of drug dependency, and had a stable home for her kids.
So there's a mismatch between the sort of law and the personal ramifications. So basically, let me get my head around this. Mm. If the defence is able to show that these records are important to their case, they will usually be released. Is that what currently happens? If the defence says, you know, we need these,
yeah,
is it usual that they do get released?
Well, there's a legal test. They have to show to a court that they can't be found elsewhere, these types of records.
Right.
And secondly, that they will have will tend to prove something. It's called substantial probative value. And thirdly, there's a public interest test where there's a balancing between the rights of an accused essentially to a fair trial and the public interest in that, and on the other hand, the public interest in protecting the confidentiality of the counselling relationship to encourage other people to seek assistance. And it also takes into account the risk of harm to the victim. So the laws on the face of it appear quite reasonable, although often I've found that they swing in favour more of the rights of the accused rather than the risk of harm to the victim.
Okay.
However, while I think there could be more far-reaching and longer-term law reform changes, in the interim, we need changes to procedure to ensure that people are having an adequate chance to stand up for their rights to have their counselling records kept confidential. And for that, we need free legal representation.
And we'll get to that in a minute, because I'm still kind of caught up with the woman you were talking about before.
Yeah.
You mentioned that case that, you know, the impact of this was really traumatising for her. How else does the fact that they're suddenly confronted with their personal secrets on show, so to speak, impacted on your clients?
Well, I had one client, this was one of my early cases and what triggered this project, who said to me, well, if the accused gets to look at my counselling records, I'll feel violated all over again. Mm. And this was a crime that really impacted on the kind of trust relationship they had. And she also said, and I'm not going to see a counsellor ever again after this. It had such a deep impact on her. In another case, more recently, that we've been running with a pilot, I'm aware that the client has said, well, if they do get my counselling records, I'm going to pull out of the prosecution. Mm. And sexual assault, as you and I'm sure many listeners know, is an underreported crime, one of the most unreported crimes worldwide. And in New South Wales, we have 9,500 reported incidents of sexual and indecent assault per year, but we have a 1% or just under 1% conviction rate. You can see that this issue of counselling notes is one another obstacle that needn't, I would say, exist.
Yeah, and some of the victims are children or people with intellectual disabilities. I mean, it's hard to imagine how distressing it must be for them and their families.
Well, that's right. That's right. And for anyone, and in particular people who have a lot of documentation in their life that might be brought before the court, but also for particularly vulnerable victims or any sexual assault victim, the idea that we're asking either them to stand up in court or to pay a solicitor is really unfair. They're basically, we're asking them to foot the burden for helping the state to prosecute a devastating crime.
Yeah. So this is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Jane Caro, and my guest today is Alicia Gillard, solicitor with the New South Wales Women's Legal Service. The pilot project you're working on, who is taking part to provide the legal advice? Who's working with you to help?
Well, it's an exciting innovation, and I'm really pleased that it's running along so well. We've got the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions. We have the New South Wales Bar Association and its members, and three of Australia's leading law firms, Blake Dawson, Clayton Utes and Freehills, in association with Women's Legal Services New South Wales. So the way it works is that the DPP, that's the prosecutors, are referring clients to the law firms, Women's Legal Services and the bar, and we're providing free legal representation. So a solicitor and a barrister to act for the victim. It's a small pilot. It's only operating in the Downing Centre in Sydney City. Mm-hmm. It's a drop in the ocean.
Yeah.
At any one time, there are over 1,000 sexual assault cases running in New South Wales. So unfortunately, some people aren't going to be assisted. What we are doing is evaluating what we do very closely. So we hope that those findings will then inform law and policy reform debate so that we can achieve a more broad-reaching form of assistance.
That sounds great. But how will the pilot work in practice? Could you give us like a likely scenario of once it's up and running, what difference it would make to the situation of people who find themselves victims of sexual assault?
Yeah, sure. So if we had a sexual assault victim who was involved in a criminal trial, the defence counsel may have subpoenaed her GP, general practitioner, psychologist, psychiatrist, Medicare, school records, which may contain school counselling records. It can be very broad.
Wow.
And how this pilot assists is that the DPP will refer the client to a group of solicitors. One of us will put up our hand, and then we will be able to provide advice, and we'll also be able to put a wedge in proceedings, essentially, to make sure that we have looked at the records to identify if there are any protected, if there's any protective material in there. And it doesn't always come with neon lights saying counselling records. It needs to be looked at. Once we identify the counselling records, we can then raise an argument in court about why there shouldn't be access. So instead of defence either just having automatic access to them because they haven't been identified or having a one-sided argument, we can be there to really represent the interests of the victim and also to make it a less bewildering process. Yes. And
remove one of the barriers to people actually prosecuting their case.
Remove one of the barriers and stop people from withdrawing or refusing to go and see counsellors again.
And so you'd be hoping that this might be adopted more widely than simply New South Wales, for example.
Well, the law that I've been talking about is only applicable in New South Wales. However, there are similar types of laws elsewhere in Australia. And this issue is now on the national agenda, and Women's Legal Services has assisted with that.
That's fantastic, Alicia. Thank you for joining us today. Alicia Gillard is a solicitor with the New South Wales Women's Legal Service. You'll find further information about this project on the Life Matters website. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Jane Currow. Next on Life Matters, a hopeful story of urban renewal.
It's got to be the only trad jazz version of K-San. It's the Hoodangers, Melbourne group who have toured the world from their live concert in Denmark. Playing trad jazz pieces, their own compositions. This one, they even play a version of Dylan's Don't Think Twice. It's all right. They're a lot of fun, and they're our feature artists on the Daily Planet. Afternoons at 2:20 and evenings at 11:20. Right here on ABC Radio National.
Lots of people just can't wait to leave their small hometown. Many of them leave in their early 20s wanting to explore the world. Perhaps their hometown felt too small, not exciting enough, or the economic reality meant it was just too hard to get a job. Well, you're about to meet a man who's never given up on the place where he grew up. Arts commentator Marcus Westbury was born in Newcastle in New South Wales. The city's port is a gateway for the world's largest export of coal. But over recent decades, the Newcastle CBD has pretty much died. There are over 130 empty buildings in the two main streets of the city centre. Now in his 30s, Marcus has returned to his hometown to try and revitalise the two main streets. He's working on a project called Renew Newcastle and joins me on Life Matters. Hi, Marcus.
Good morning. Hi.
What's the philosophy behind the project?
Well, it's pretty simple. I mean, at a basic level, Newcastle has this problem of all these empty buildings in the main streets. And what we've done is set up a system so that while they're sitting empty, we can borrow them from the people that own them and make them available to people who may not have much money but may have really good ideas for things that they can do in them and create in them. And in doing so, we're basically creating a strategy that brings the city back to life.
Wow. So, and I hear that when you were 18, you were walking through the streets with your friend, imagining a world where all the empty buildings were, as you say, filled with life. So tell me about this, you know, very early genesis of the project.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is an idea that's been with me for about as long as I can remember. I'm 35 now, so I realise it was basically about half my life ago that my friend Sean and I, who has gone on to, he and I founded a lot of sort of cultural events and projects together down the years. But one of the things we first bonded over was walking down the streets of Newcastle, looking in the windows of the empty buildings and thinking up great sort of fantastic and at the time probably quite ludicrous ideas for things that we wanted to do in them. And unfortunately then, as until very recently, there really was no system to allow people who are creative or who have things that they might be able to do and get into some of these spaces and bring them to life. There's kind of basically a kind of an economic failure in that there are so many empty buildings and yet they're not actually cheap enough or accessible enough or flexible enough to be made available to the people who can afford to use them and do things with them, or at least until we set up this system.
Right. But to get back to the hometown thing again, what made you, Marcus, persevere and not simply walk away from it?
Look, I love Newcastle. I stayed there until my mid-20s. I mean, a lot of people tend to leave the place they grow up straight out of school or the first opportunity, and I stayed there for a long time. I was involved in doing quite a few festivals and events and projects and starting different sort of community things there. And then at some point, the sort of economics of your life kind of drives you away. And, you know, I'm trying to think if I've ever had a paid job in Newcastle. I'd be struggling to think if I have. The reality of the place is, I mean, when I left school there, there was about 40-something percent youth unemployment. So it was pretty tough to make a living there. And then over the years, that's driven me away to Sydney and Melbourne now, where I've been able to do, you know, I've had a lot of success in other things that I've been doing, and it's been great. But I've never really let go of the idea. I go back to Newcastle a fair bit, and I think in one sense that the sort of emptying out of the inner city is much more obvious to me as someone who goes away and comes back than if you live there. Because if you live there, you sort of, you know, one, you know, some shop closes down this week and you sort of don't really think about it too much. If you go away and come back and go on away and come back, you can see this kind of time lapse effect where you're suddenly staring at a block and thinking, last time I really looked at this block, there was a lot of things here and now there's nothing. And so, you know, that sense of you know, being back and forth all the time and sort of witnessing this happen has always been in the back of my mind. And then last year, the year before last, actually, I got a chance to make a TV series, or I've made a couple now for the ABC, called Not Quite Art. And the very first episode of the first series was really looking at this idea of where culture comes from. And I went to Newcastle and compared it to Glasgow, which is another city with a sort of similar dynamic, but a much more vibrant sort of cultural scene. And in part because of these kind of strategies, because they're about getting people to do things. And then, you know, if you ever want to get, you know, a change made somewhere, it's I can strongly recommend having a TV series. It's a really excellent way of putting an issue on the agenda and getting people to talk about things that they might not otherwise talk about. So
certainly resonates with me.
Yeah, that certainly just puts you in a position to you know, I suddenly found myself last year in a position where people were coming to me to talk to me about this problem, and people who could actually do something about it. And then suddenly I was obliged, you know, put my money where my mouth is and get serious about doing something about it.
Yeah, and I mean, Newcastle's had a hell of a history, really, hasn't it? I mean, we've seen the shutdown of BHP, which has affected the town, but also the building of mammoth shopping centres away from the city. How's that affected the city's culture?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big problem in Newcastle. People tend to look at Newcastle's got a very weird sort of it's an unusual, distinctive dynamic, which is the old centre of the city isn't the centre. It's actually on sort of one edge of the area where people live. It evolved from the days of public transport, and it's got this long main street where the trams used to run, and the trains used to bring everyone into town. And nowadays, that's not the shopping pattern anymore. So there are a whole series of quite successful booming shopping centres out in the suburbs. It's not, you know, people look at all the empty buildings in the main street and think that the entire economy's left. It's not that bad. It's just that the changing patterns have meant that that part of town has a very, you know, its old use doesn't make sense anymore. And so like a lot of cities, I guess like any city or any town where the main old main street has been supplanted by a shopping centre on the edge of town, it's got this kind of hollowed out empty shops effect.
Mm-hmm. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Jane Caro, and I'm talking now with arts commentator Marcus Westbury about the project to renew his hometown. It's called Renew Newcastle. So tell me about some of the buildings you've brought back to life. The Fletcher Jones building is a good example.
Yeah, so we've been quite lucky in that managed to convince a bunch of property owners to let us have their building. One in particular, the GPT Group, own a lot of property in the centre of Newcastle for redevelopment that's now not going to go ahead in the near future. And one of the buildings that they own is this Fletcher Jones building. And it was a closed store until, I'm not sure, probably 5 years ago at a guess. And like any of these buildings all have real history. You know, they're not just empty buildings. They're actually, you know, places that were once part of people's lives. I was out the front looking at this building, and a woman came up to me who was, I'm assuming, probably in her 70s, and explained that her husband bought the suit for their wedding at this shop, and she was so pleased to see that it was open again. And so that's a building that's been sitting empty for a while. We've got a group of artists in there. It's now a gallery. It's been running as a gallery since February. It's a sound and multimedia gallery. There's now a rolling program of events and activities. It's bringing people to the city, and it shares this sort of strip of half a dozen shops with other places. Everything from crafts to photo galleries, to people who make their own clothes, bags, jewellery, etc. It's about getting that kind of creative energy in the community and getting it onto the street.
Great. And you've got another story about the church. A woman showed you the press clipping from the last service there.
Yeah. One of the first buildings that we took on was a church, which had not been empty all that long. It'd been empty for about 3 years, I think. But, you know, by Newcastle standards, that's not too bad. But the church had been a Catholic church, and it had been it had closed down a few years ago. I'm assuming just mainly due to, you know, changing patterns of congregations and where people were living. But we have since moved into it, and we're using that as an administrative centre, and also holding our public meetings there for the project. And we held a meeting and a tour. And the next day, a woman came back and gave me a clipping of from when the church had closed down, which was almost 3 years, I think, to the day that we had reopened it again for this project. And obviously, you know, as someone, she'd been a parishioner in the church there for a long time, and you know, that building meant a lot to her. It had a lot of history to her. So she was just delighted to see that we were in there and making it active and making use of it again.
Mm. From a planning point of view, how have you managed to keep this project going? Haven't planning laws and red tape got in the way a bit for you?
Yeah, it's actually not all that easy to do this stuff. Essentially, what we've been very lucky. A local law firm, Spark Elmore, have done a lot of pro bono work for us in setting up these basic agreements that allow us to access the spaces in an ongoing way. And basically, the standard deal is that we borrow a space for 30 days at a rolling 30-day period, so that if the owner gets a better offer or a commercial offer, or their redevelopment is going ahead or whatever, they can take the building back. In our case, what this means is then that it's very difficult to find uses that actually fit the pre-existing development consents. And for a rolling 30-day basis, it's not actually worth your while. It's so expensive and so difficult in terms of being able to vary any usages that it becomes quite problematic. And there's examples now. The UK is rolling out a similar scheme nationwide now. They've got a similar problem with empty shops in main streets in towns and in parts of London. So what they've been doing is introduce a whole package of incentives that are both financial but also just about making the red tape and the regulation that covers temporary usages easier. Because we don't have a system of temporary use. We don't have a set of strategies that are about doing things in the short term. And our project is very much based around the idea that the people that we're getting into the spaces don't have much capital. So once you've got to spend thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars just to get permission to do something, you've probably blown the whole budget for the whole project.
Yeah. Speaking of capital, you recently criticised an announcement from the New South Wales government about the planned $1 billion makeover of the Sydney Opera House, saying it could seed fund, I love this, 66,666 Renew Newcastles. Could that be seen as sour grapes, Marcus?
A little bit, yeah, I'll take that. But I think the larger point I'm trying to make is that I think we make, in terms of cultural policy, I think we make some really false assumptions, and that is that culture comes from places like the Opera House, and in that context, it makes sense to spend $1 billion to renovate. You know, it's a serious debate about whether to spend $1 billion to renovate the Opera House and return it to its original vision. However, trying to start new projects like this, I mean, basically, you know, I've had to do this on my credit card, you know. So we're now in a position after 9 months of operation where we are getting funding from the New South Wales government. I'm very grateful for that, and that allows us to now have a manager on the ground in Newcastle, so I don't need to be there all the time. And, you know, there's a lot of great benefits. However, I think that, you know, essentially we've sort of got two arts and cultural worlds, one that has huge budgets and enormous amounts of resources where amounts of $1 billion make sense. And then there's another one at the other end of the spectrum where there's almost no resources, you know, even for projects that have such obvious demonstrated benefits as the one that we've been involved in. As I said, I mean, I've been running the festival in Newcastle for 5 years, which is the largest tourism event in the city, and now this project, I have never been paid for any of it.
Marcus, you're a champion, I tell you what. Listen, Marcus, I'm sorry, we could go on about this for much longer. It's fascinating, and I really commend what you're doing, but time is a tyrant, so thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
No, it's been a pleasure talking to you. And again, if you'd like more details on Renew Newcastle, check out the Life Matters website at abc.net.au/rn/Life Matters. I'm Jane Caro, in the chair this week for Richard Aidy. Still to come today, Caroline Jones joins me to discuss her new book. But next, A School Without Teachers or Classrooms. Teaching is a vocation, they say, but so often a dedicated, well-meaning teacher is completely thwarted by a classroom full of kids really not all that interested in learning. Today we visit a tiny school in the Adelaide Hills which hosts hundreds of national and international visitors each year. The visitors are keen to learn the secret of how the students at this school have developed a love of learning. Annie Hastwell takes up the story.
What are you boys about to do?
We're about to paint this and we're doing a book project and we're going to make the model with plaster, then put it in there and then paint the background.
Hi, my name's Louie and I'm in year four and my personal learning's on volcanoes and Declan's doing volcanoes as well. He's a friend of mine and The reason I'm doing volcanoes is because I'm so interested. Did you know, if there was no volcanoes, there would be no rain and no water.
Bridgewater Primary School is a small state school serving a fairly average demographic in the foothills of Adelaide. But on closer inspection, there are some crucial differences. For a start, children and teachers are on first-name terms, and students decide what they want to learn and when.
Everyone grows at a different rate. Everyone needs different time. Everyone has different passions and skills, and we need to capitalise on each individual and allow them to move forward in the way that they can. And our job is to make that happen as well as we can.
Bridgewater Principal Roz Shepherd is showing me around.
The art tech room, and obviously, when kids come in here, some of them will come to have a focus meeting, and focus meetings happen in the school for a variety of reasons. It's the actual explicit learning time that happens is called a focus meeting, and that can be explicit for maths or English or research skills or art or anything. So throughout the school, children have what we call a movement note, which is like a lanyard that they wear that's laminated so they can record on there where they want to go and work from their home group. And then as long as their teacher, a learning area adult we would call them, as long as that's signed, then they have the right to be in those places as long as they don't abuse the right.
So it gives them quite a degree of independence.
Yes, yes. So the older children from year three on, they have their own timetable. So every morning they fill in the timetable, and on that timetable there's expectations that there are certain times when they do all need to be together, do need to be available for focus meetings in a certain area, those sorts of things. But then there are places on the timetable where they have the choice about which part of their learning they're getting on with. So they would be using then the movement note to make that turn into action. So they might be going to the library to research, they might be going outside to sketch something, they might be coming to the tech room to make something, they might be going to interview someone else, they might be going to another part of the school to have a presentation or to ask questions for a survey. But the movement note allows them to follow up on their decision.
Jarrah showed me his timetable.
At the beginning we always do timetable and roll. Then we do language activities and spelling and silent writing. Then we edit and...
Is there a time then where you go and choose what you want to do, though, isn't there?
Yeah, that's personal time or personal learning.
What is personal learning?
It's like where you choose a topic and you find out a bit on it, about it and present it. And
what's your topic?
Mine's on how cars work. Yeah.
And what will you? How far have you got into that topic? What have you explored?
I've done quite a bit. I'm onto my PowerPoint now, so yeah.
We'd made some changes up to 2000. We certainly weren't what I would call a completely authoritarian school. It wasn't chalk and talk completely. It wasn't necessarily adult knows, children listen, children regurgitate. We'd moved away from that slowly from when I started here in 1995. And we'd certainly found that the more that we moved towards involving children in the decision making and having them have a closer idea of the reasons behind what we were doing, that it meant that they were starting to be more engaged and more connected, and therefore there were less behaviour issues.
Why the need for change?
Because we were well aware of the current research that had been developed through brain research, But it was around the year 2000 when we looked at the language that we were using, the labels that we were using, and said, right, we need to create a new culture. And so that means that now we talk about learning area adult. We don't talk about teacher. We talk about learning areas, not classes. We don't actually use year levels in the way that we describe groups of kids. They don't do something just because they're a year three. They do it because it's where they're at with their learning and something that's important for them. We don't use any marks or grades or percentages, but we do give lots and lots of verbal and written feedback very precisely to both students and to parents. We believe that assessment should be ongoing and should be for learning rather than assessment of learning, so it happens regularly rather than at the end of some learning.
I've just come into a room where there are a lot of fairly absorbed kids working on computers or bent over their books. Now, it's not a classroom. Need to get the terminology right. It's a learning area, the green learning area, in fact. And Pam is not the teacher. She's Pam to the children, and she's the learning area adult.
The character real. If you've done that, then you need to look up for your editing. It's on the board.
Pam Romanis, and I've taught at Bridgewater Primary School for about 10 years, or a little bit more.
So you were here when the change happened, when a different style of learning came in. What are your memories of that time?
It was actually very exciting. I remember when we first started off, the excitement from the kids and the amazing things that they decided to work on. We had one boy who was obsessed with Tesla coils. Do I know anything about Tesla coils? No. Do I want to? No. But he was absolutely obsessed with that. We had another girl in the first couple of years, another girl who was very, very keen on the refugee problem because it was right in the middle of the Tampa and all of those things happening. She did an absolutely amazing piece of work around that. So very exciting times.
You're working with a curriculum, which is quite a strict curriculum and a statewide one, and at the same time giving the children freedom to explore their own ideas. How do you make those two things work together?
You absolutely definitely can. As far as the skills of the curriculum go, you can get those skills through absolutely anything that the kids are interested in at all. As far as the bigger picture about making sure that they do science and they have society and environment and all of those sorts of things coming in, that's where the teacher has to look at what the kids have worked on over an amount of time. So if we've got someone who's only looking at animals, it's time to move them on to looking at other things.
The theories underpinning the way things are done at Bridgewater are part of a South Australian government initiative called Learning to Learn. Neuroscientist Professor Martin Westwell first came across it when he visited Australia a few years ago from Oxford, where he was Deputy Director of the Institute for the Future of the Mind.
We talk a lot about teaching and learning, and yet with things like, you know, in the UK and now in Australia, with national testing and things like that, it's less about learning and more about performance. You know, from my background, we see the evidence from the UK telling us that the more tests we put in, the more the syllabus is driven, it becomes tick box, the less kids learn, even though they do really well on tests. And what we were seeing at Bridgewater, and I think across, even when I went to speak to students in some of the Learning to Learn schools across South Australia, in the senior schools, we saw the same thing. You know, these older kids were seeing themselves as learners. School wasn't this wonderful thing that they all enjoyed every day, but they knew the purpose. They could see themselves as learners. And so that really was the standout difference. And so when, after my first visit, when I went back to the UK, from a personal point of view, I actually said, you know, I wish there was a school like Bridgewater School in the UK for our boys.
Westwell now lives in Adelaide. He heads up Flinders University's Centre for Science Education for the 21st Century, and his boys go to Bridgewater Primary.
It's been really working out very well. All the things that we'd hoped for from changing the environment and from the boys being in that context has come to fruition, so we're really very pleased. My eldest really, really struggled with his reading, and when he came to Australia, when he came to Bridgewater, it wasn't too long before he almost had a kind of renaissance as a learner, as a reader, because he came home and he said, you know, now I can do reading because I can read what I want to read rather than what I'm told to read. And he started engaging with reading. And now he's a voracious reader. You know, he doesn't really put a book down.
As a public school, Bridgewater's been a bit of a focus of interest for whether doing education differently affects academic results, especially in an era when back-to-basics testing is very much in vogue. Pam Romanis says the children at the school score above average in standard maths and literacy tests and did well as part of a more comprehensive study a few years ago.
The results of that show that the kids who were working in the non-traditional way, kids at our school, not only were they more engaged in what they were doing, but they actually knew why they were doing whatever it was they were doing. So I think that's a really important thing. Often you can come into our school and you can look and see what the children are doing and you might think, well, that looks pretty Mickey Mouse. But I think the proof is when you start to talk to the kids about what they're getting out of it and what they know about themselves as a learner, and how learning works for them. You know, they're the things that they take with them forever, I think.
And what about if they were to be measured, or are they measured on literacy and numeracy levels?
As far as the NAPLAN type things go, our kids actually are doing very well. We're above state averages. We have a system where we look at kids within their own learning of being either a novice, a beginning learner, a learner, an advanced learner at a particular skill. They can often gauge that themselves, and they often do gauge that themselves, and so they assess themselves and then we also assess where they're going. So there's lots of assessing going on. It's not a free-for-all by any means.
Hi, my name's Tay. I'm in year five, and my favourite part of the school is probably all the choices you get.
And that's Annie Hestwell reporting. Has that story struck a chord with you? I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can call the Life Matters listener line on 02 833 1430, or send an email or guestbook post via our website at abc.net.au/rn/Life Matters.
As far as damage to the land, this flood's probably done more damage in 8 weeks than what 100 years of grazing could do. It's just devastated certain areas of the land. There's not a blade of grass on a lot of it. So, yeah, it's pretty sad to look at. It just looks like there's been a bomb go off there. It's that bad.
Queensland's Gulf Country struggles to regain its feet. Bush Telegraph, this morning after the news at 11 on ABC Radio National.
Now to a voice known and loved by generations of ABC listeners and viewers. Caroline Jones has been a trailblazing broadcaster. There was her work on This Day Tonight, then on ABC Radio National with The Search for Meaning, which was broadcast from 1987 to 1994. And most recently, she's the face of Australian Story on ABC Television. After decades of getting other people to tell their stories, Caroline has now written a detailed memoir of dealing with the death of her father and what was for her the shocking grief that followed. It's called Through a Glass Darkly, and it's my pleasure to welcome Caroline Jones back to Radio National.
Thank you. It's very good to be back, Jane.
Caroline, your father was 93, living at home with his wife Mary and coping quite well with the rigours of age. So what happened?
Well, he had angina for years, you know, and after some years, the usual treatments were not working anymore. It was thought by his surgeons, and he agreed that open-heart surgery might be worth a try. Pretty amazing, I thought. And I wished he hadn't made the choice, but they thought it was possible, and he agreed. So off we went. And he came through the surgery reasonably well, although he was very old and frail and tired. But it was the aftermath, really, that produced a good deal of suffering. He spent, very unusually, 6 weeks in intensive care, and then he graduated to the ward for 2 weeks, and that was as far as he could go. But it was that 6 weeks in intensive care, I think, that was a tremendous ordeal for him, and by extension for me, because I spent part of most days with him.
Yeah, what was it like watching from the sidelines, watching what you say in your book was great suffering?
I was in conflict because I felt the people, the doctors, the nurses, the physios, everybody, all those carers, were marvellous, compassionate, skillful, brilliant. But the interventions are often quite technological and pretty challenging.
Yes.
So I was really in conflict. I thought, good people doing things I don't like to my beloved father.
Yes.
And I didn't want to show any disapproval or too much querying, because I knew they were doing it for a good reason. And I also thought, I better be good in this situation. I want to be acceptable. I want to be here. I want to be his advocate. I want to learn about everything that they're doing for him. I want to understand it. I want to be his voice. Because most unfortunately, he was unable to be weaned, as it were, from the ventilator.
Yeah.
Now, a ventilator or a respirator is a good thing when you're just coming out of surgery and you're unconscious. But once you become conscious, you know that you've got a tube going down your throat or into your lungs. You can't, he couldn't eat or drink or even have a drop of water put onto his into his mouth. He couldn't speak. He couldn't call out. He couldn't tell us what he needed. And that went on for many weeks, and that was very, very hard for him and for me, because I became even more concerned that I might not be understanding what he needed and not being his advocate adequately and so on. So I found it devastating.
Yeah,
really.
I can imagine.
You know, that feeling when you wake up in the morning and just for an instant or two you see the sky is blue and your heart swells and you're happy, and then the shroud of dread descends and you know that poor Dad is in this frightful situation. I think seeing the suffering or accompanying the suffering of someone you love is the worst thing. Anyone who has a sick child, sick parent, your own suffering you can cope with, I think, because you know what your own resources are, but you're not quite sure about your beloved who's suffering, and I think that's the worst aspect of it. So,
and you talk about this tremendous sense of responsibility to be his advocate, to do his talking for him, which I suppose meant that you had to put your own life entirely on hold. I mean, that's a common story for many carers. And you continued to work, but presumably you say in the book a bit on autopilot. And you also mentioned that your beloved dancing classes had to come to an end. You know, what's that like, having to kind of put your life on ice for a while?
Well, in a way, I kept working. You see, I kept working. I think you're also living a double life.
Yeah.
Because I did keep working, and work many times has saved me. Work's normal. Work's manageable.
Yes.
Work's engrossing. Mm-hmm. So I was doing that as well as spending much of each day with Dad. Dancing, well, dancing seemed too frivolous, Jane.
Yeah, I thought, I can understand.
I can't be off dancing while Dad's in this situation. So it took me ages to get back to that.
And even after all this awful time, your father's eventual death still shocked you. You were away at the time, which makes it even worse, I suppose, particularly as you'd been so vigilant for all that time. But even so, why was it so shocking? I mean, he was 93.
Yes, isn't it surprising? Mm. Because I thought, well, I'll accept Dad when he goes. It's been so wonderful having this gorgeous dad in my life for all these years. He's tired, he's worn out, he's been caring for Mary, his wife, for all these years too. And I thought I would accept it, but anyhow, it didn't work out that way. So it did surprise me.
Yeah.
And it went on for a long time. Grief is I think grief must be an underrated sort of what do you call it? I came to think of it as a sort of severe illness bordering on derangement. I really do think that I went mad for a while, but it affected me physically, emotionally. I was up and down all over the place. Sometimes I was angry. Sometimes I was numb. And that went on for quite a long time. It was surprisingly dislocating. Sometimes I was very sad. Sometimes I was quite disconnected from whatever else was happening. And, yes, it surprised me greatly.
It's funny we don't talk about it more and kind of normalise these feelings, isn't it?
I don't think people want to talk about it too much, because they'd like you to get on with it, especially, I mean, I'm an adult and a senior adult. People don't expect you to go into a decline over the death of an aged parent. I think grief's an uncomfortable thing because it can hook into somebody else's grief that they've got nicely under control. And so I did do my best to get on with it, but it took a long while.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Caroline Jones, as you probably recognise from her voice, is my guest. Her book, Through a Glass Darkly, A Journey of Love and Grief with My Father, is published by ABC Books. What happened to your faith at this time when you were going, as you say, a little bit mad?
Well, I think I lost it or forgot it. I didn't think that God could get us out of the situation we were in. And I used to go to church sometimes after Dad died and be pleased that the people, other people who were there, seemed to have faith and seemed to be getting on with it. I received the sacraments, which is always a wonderful experience for me, but I certainly became disconnected from it. I'm still not sure why. I think I slipped back into thinking I alone am responsible for this situation. I have to fix it. Mm-hmm. And simply forgot. It shocked me, I can tell you. If you'd asked me a month before all that happened, what's the place of faith in your life, I would have said it was central. Mm. So that was quite a disappointment. I think it might have been because I had a kind of childlike image of God as someone who was a nice big Santa Claus father in the sky who actually could fix everything, and had to shift over a period of years, actually, into finding another image of God that would stand by me in a crisis. So it took a long while, Jane, but I think God is now, I think I see God in the companionship and the support of people. So I think I have a more realistic image of who or what the mystery of God might be. But there was so much support and love and help, even from strangers. If I think just about the care of the medical staff, I mean, they're strangers. They don't know my dad.
No.
And yet they come to his aid so beautifully, so faithfully. And all that sort of thing, although you can't see it perhaps when it's actually happening, when I, as the months and the years went on and I reflected back on all these things and I kept writing about them, which I think for me is very clarifying, then gradually a different perspective emerges.
Yes, and you write, it's, I found this really wonderful, really, that you write of not being able to let go of the simple longing for my parents to be alive still.
Someone suggested to me that that could be because I don't have children of my own. And I thought, that's really interesting, because if you've got your own kids, you're obviously engrossed in their well-being, in today, in school or university or whatever they're doing. And so you're pulled into the present and the future. But for a person without children, even though I have a lot of people in my orbit that I love and I care about and I do things with, that rang true for me a bit. But, well, your parents have been with you all your life. You know, they gave me life. They gave me so much encouragement. I think it's natural to miss one's parents, but before too long you have to come to the understanding that they don't want you sitting around being miserable. So I think an effort of will is required at a certain time to choose to remember positive images, good times, all that they gave you, instead of being sad and unhappy because you haven't got them anymore.
Yes.
And also I think perhaps miraculously over a period of time I have become aware of the spiritual presence of my mother and father. That sounds a bit wacky, doesn't it? But what do I mean? The memory of their, all that they did for me, and of course part of them has become me.
Yes.
And I've incorporated some of their characteristics, I hope. And so it all changes, but it all changes slowly in grief, I think, and maybe it should, and slowly and perhaps unconsciously. But I felt for ages as though I was behind a pane of glass and everything else was going on the other side of that pane of glass and I was isolated. That image is probably quite familiar to a lot of people going through grief.
Yes.
And, you know, the book is only intended as a companion for somebody else going through a time of loss. It's not self-help. It hasn't got the answers to grief because I don't know what they are.
No.
So it's just for companionship. Sometimes it's nice to read someone else's experience when you're going through a tough time.
I think that's true. And at the same time as dealing with all these emotions, you still had the welfare of your father's wife, Mary, to consider. And I really love this bit too. You longed for a sibling at times to help you share the load.
Well, I did, but I mean, that's just thinking, gosh, you know, where's the brother or the sister that I can get to help me make these decisions? But look, that could also be troublesome, couldn't it? I hear some horror stories of people who say, oh, if only my sister wasn't such a pain, you know, we'd be getting all this done.
There is an emotional sharing that could go on, though, isn't there?
Well, I guess so, but you see, I don't know it, so But Mary and I had a very interesting time. I mean, Dad and Mary married when he was in his 60s and she in her 50s, they had first met during the war.
Mm.
And the way she describes it, it was a brief encounter.
Oh, but how romantic.
It is romantic, but it must have been a very memorable encounter because years and years and years later, after my mother died, Dad went looking for Mary and they married and they had 27 years of married life together. They were both strong personalities, so I think they had their moments. But Mary and I were something else. We were like chalk and cheese. So we had to really work hard at getting on.
Mm.
And Mary had the gift of contrariness. I don't know if you've ever struck a contrary person.
Oh, once or twice.
Have you? You say black, they say white. So really, we had our moments. But I'm so happy that we hung in there.
Mm.
Even after there was a real reason, that is Dad, to keep us together. Because, I mean, it's easy to get on with someone you love or someone who's a kindred spirit. But when there's a real challenge in it and you're so different, I mean, my instinct is to bolt.
Yeah.
I'd run a mile, but I didn't. And I'm glad I didn't. And we hung in there till, for 7 years after Dad died, Mary was still around. And I went with her through the what shall we do now with the home? Is it best to go to retirement village? Yes, she did. And all of that stuff that many people listening will be very familiar with.
Mm.
And nobody gives us training to look after ageing parents. There's no manual for it. I wish there was because I made plenty of mistakes. But, well, we got there.
Mm. Well, and eventually comfort came in some of the simplest things, according to your book. You write, for example, about the presence of magpies. Why were they so meaningful?
Because I have a beautiful image of Dad in his pocket handkerchief-sized garden in their little unit. He created this beautiful little garden out the back. He'd grow hydrangeas in his compost. He'd grow geraniums from cuttings. It was bright and colourful. He had green fingers. And he loved to feed the magpies. So I've got this beautiful picture of Dad in his funny old shorts tied up with an old necktie and his knobbly old gnarled old legs and his hand reaching out to the magpies with some morsel of yesterday's sandwiches. And you know, the skin of an old person becomes very transparent and very bruised, and I can see this gentle hand reaching out and feeding a circle of magpies that stalk forward very cautiously and take some food. And that's one of the most beautiful images I have of him. So after he died, whenever I saw magpies, I thought, oh, hello, Dad. You know, they're just funny things like that that really do give you great comfort. Or maybe you have gone a bit mad and you're looking for beautiful little images. But I've got many magnificent memories of Dad. I mean, he was very practical. He did his own washing by hand, his own mending, and that was a sight to see him mending his socks.
Good for him.
All was marvellous with the wrong coloured string and everything, cotton. But he was a practical, resourceful, delightful, conversational, interesting bloke. And it was just so great to have him in my life for all those years.
He sounds like a wonderful man. Caroline Jones, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you for being interested in the book.
Oh, I was very interested, and it's, as I say, a pleasure to meet you. Caroline's book, Through a Glass Darkly, A Journey of Love and Grief with My Father, is published by ABC Books. The book show is next, speaking of books, after the news on Radio National with Ramona Cavall. Ramona, what's coming up today?
Well, hi, Jane. Look, I don't know how you feel, but I always get very sort of very testy about reading a book set in a sort of non-place, especially when with characters that don't have names. But I'm very fond of knowing where I am and who I'm with. And we're going to be talking today to two Melbourne-based writers, Shane Maloney and Tony Birch, about the importance of location in their work and how we can think about place in writing. And also, first in our series of New Australian Literary Magazines, we're looking at a journal, Torpedo, celebrating the work of Richard Brautigan.
Sounds wonderful. Thanks, Ramona. The book show is after the news. I'm Jane Caro, here all this week with Life Matters. Tomorrow, join me to discuss the pleasures and sorrows of work. Caroline mentioned that. With the everyday philosopher Alain de Botton, and a love story as well. Love in the Age of Drought, actually. Hope you can join me for that and more. But bye for now.
Is it the modern equivalent of the Snowy Mountains scheme or a road to nowhere? The Rudd government's plan to build a $43 billion national broadband network, 100 times faster than the current internet. Visionary nation building or a big gamble using taxpayers' dollars? Listen now or download as an MP3 podcast from the Radio National website at abc.net.au/rn and follow the prompts to Australia Talks.